Hi, and welcome to Hyperfixations, the podcast where we invite various interesting people on to talk about their niche area of interest so they could just talk forever about. Here are your hosts. I'm Ali.
And I'm Nigel.
And today we have a return guest, Ellen. Ellen, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you so much for having me back. It was so much fun the last time.
Thank you. Yeah, no, the last one was a lot of fun. That was a good episode.
Yeah, I re-listened to that because it makes me happy. I actually have been trying to force like all the people in my life to listen to that episode because I'm like, this is my hour of fame because, you know, it was an hour long podcast, not 15 minutes. Andy Warhol, eat your heart out.
Do what I did with my family for mine, because mine came out the weekend of my birthday, and on my birthday I was like, we're having a listening party.
Oh my god, I love that. I literally tried to force my father to listen to it in the car, and when it got to the part where I was talking about lesbian vampires, he was like, okay, let's stop the car and get out. We should do something else.
Fathers.
Fathers. Mothers. Everybody.
Parents. People.
People. That's why we have fairy tales, so that we can set people on fire when we can't do it in real life.
And that leads us on to what are you talking to us about today?
Fairy tales!
Hey!
Something I'm super duper obsessed with. And testament to that fact is by my bedside right now, I have a 600-page non-fiction book about the history of fairy tales. And it's not the only 600-page book I have on that topic in my room. I'm a nerd. I don't have friends. Anyway.
Hey!
Ali's, it's dubious whether or not Ali's real or whether she's a figment of my very lurid imagination.
I mean, look, fair enough.
So what does that make me then?
I don't know. Maybe a hallucination? What would you like to be?
I want to be emaciated.
You mean like real skinny?
No, like the Boy Genius lyric.
Is
that on the new album or?
No, that's from me and my dog from the original.
That's because I'm a fake fan.
Your dog is emaciated?
No, the song is called Me and My Dog.
Oh. Yeah, I don't... To be honest, I've just moved into a new accommodation situation, and there's construction work going on, so I've been listening to a lot of opera, so I don't any modern music.
You should listen to Boy Genius, though. I'd recommend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why fairy tales? Why did you choose them for today's episode? How did you first get into them?
So I've always really loved stories. I've always really loved mythology and fairy tales. When I was a little kid as well, I think everybody kind of gets into fairy tales when they're a kid because you have no choice. Most people are told fairy tales. We all kind of hear the same ones, but when I was growing up, I was so into stories, I would be wanting to write my own and reading every story I could get my hands on. So I think I was always a little bit hyperfixated with it. I remember when I was a kid, I had a friend in the playground who was also really interested in storytelling, and we used to look up stories about fairies and then we tell them to each other in the playground. And we were, as most children are, incredibly violent, bloody-minded monsters. So we used to... She was allowed... She had many older siblings and her parents were quite chill about things like letting her watch Dawn of the Dead. So she used to watch these horror movies and that I was not allowed to watch. And then she'd come to the playground and retell these gory, like, slasher movies. And I was fascinated. I was like, this is so cool. These are the stories I'm not supposed to know about. And of course, that's the age I started to have nightmares, but but I loved it. And we used to, yeah, she used to, I remember one time she came into school and she was like, girls, everyone gather around. I'm going to tell you the story of this this girl who gets a phone call from a stranger. You can guess what movie that was. And it was like fascinating. I was like, and then what happened? And then what happened? And I kept making her retell the story and she got sick of it. And she's like, just fucking watch the movie.
What movie is this?
When a Stranger Calls.
Oh. When you first said phone call, I'm so bad that when you first said, even though I know When a Stranger Calls, when you first said gets a phone call,
never heard
I
just, of this film.
I thought the ring.
Oh.
But like when you met, but then we said a phone call from a stranger, I was like, that's probably When a Stranger Calls.
Yeah, she told me the plot of The Ring as well. And
that was the first horror movie I saw.
And yeah. And to be honest, I think there's not much of a distinguishing line between a horror movie with fantastical elements and most fairy tales. Because most fairy tales, I think, are designed for crazy little kids like us who were like, give us the scary bits. Even though they give us nightmares, we're just, we're drawn to the gory details and the drama of it all. So yeah, I think that's where I got started, was me and my friend just sitting in the playground being like, making up weird stories about fairies and horror movies.
Honestly, yeah, because some fairy tales are, they're fucked up. Because I was having this discussion with my brother recently, because we were talking, like, it's about a movie, but like based on a fairy tale about Snow White, because like, I was really into Snow White as a kid, and you know, rightly so, like, what an icon. But like, looking back, like, that film, like, even I remember visually, like, a lot of it kind of looks quite dark. Like, that might be because the main thing I remember from it is the scene when she's in the woods running from the huntsman who's like trying to kill her.
Who's Chris Hemsworth?
Oh yeah, that was in the Kristen Stewart movie, wasn't it?
So which movie are you talking about, Ali?
I'm talking about the old one, like the
1937 Disney animated
the
one.
The Disney one, yeah. Because I watched that when I was like a kid, and when the part
in
went
in 1937.
Yeah. And
no, that's when it came out.
that is when I watched it. Yeah. But yeah, like I remember the scene where the evil queen turns into the old woman, and it's a funny story. I remember kind of standing kind of almost like beside, like nearly behind the TV, so I'm just like, because I didn't want to see it because it was scary, but I wanted to see it a little bit, like, you know, because I didn't want to miss anything. So yeah, fairy tales, kind of scary.
I remember when I was a child, do you remember Extravision?
Yeah.
Yes, okay, like iconic Cork mood.
I miss Extravision too.
But there was the video rental shop Extravision in near where both Ali and I grew up, and I remember we had this family tradition where on Friday nights our parents would go and pick out a VHS tape for us to watch as a family. And then, like, as we got older, we started being able to go ourselves and pick out movies. But we were kids, because our parents were picking it, they would always go and be like, okay, this says like for kids on it, or this says fairy tale on it, this will be fine. And it was never fine. Most of the time we'd watch something, and like, again, because being undiagnosed autistic, they were just like, yeah, Ellen just seems to be really terrified of everything all the time, and we can never really figure out like what the meter of that is. So I remember my dad bringing back Snow White for us to watch, and me being absolutely scared shitless by that film, by the bit in the woods. Because there were trees, and the trees were evil, and they wanted to kill her, they had faces, and they were grabbing her clothes and like ripping her clothes off her. And I think because I'd also seen The Wizard of Oz, the two got conflated in my mind. You know, the bit where the trees are, like, attacking Dorothy and throwing their apples at her? So I was like, oh my god, there's a whole forest of evil trees. They're going to eat her alive. So yeah, that scene scared me a lot, too. The witch didn't scare me, really. It was just the trees.
Yeah, I have this really clear memory of, like, her dress getting caught on, like, a tree or something, like, But yeah.
That happened to me.
That a tree tried to eat you? You got traumatized by the movie?
No, well, it was my hair. It got caught by, I don't know what, because then when I tried to find it, there was nothing there that could have snagged my hair, but it was at work. And I was up in the goods in department, and I was like walking through the boxes to try and find some stock to bring down. And something like snatched my hair and I couldn't move. It was like held fast. So I could only move as far as like the length of hair. And then it started hurting really bad because it was like, you know, going to pull out of my scalp then. And I have no idea what it was, because the guy that was with me was like, are you all right? And I was like, no, I'm caught on something. And then I reached back and like fucking pulled it. But then when I went and looked, there was no hooks, no snags, no like dangly things. So I don't know. I feel like that's sort of the tree from The Wizard of Oz.
Was just like in a shelf waiting. Like, I haven't gotten to pick on a child since the 30s. This is great.
This wasn't even like by shelves. This is sort of like an open area where there was boxes sitting on pallets, like out in the open.
Well, then in that case, clearly it was a ghost.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what other reasonable explanation is there?
That's true.
Two ghosts.
So we've all kind of been slightly traumatized by Snow White.
Yeah.
No.
But by getting something caught in something, which is like you're just living
That's
Snow
the
White.
That's no.
Both.
Huh?
I don't think
you were living Snow White / The Wizard of Oz, like, for real. Like,
yeah, I don't think I've ever seen Snow White.
No.
Or at least not in its entirety.
So I have a friend who is she's Chinese. She grew up in China, and it was only in her 20s that she came to England and then later Ireland. Now she lives in Ireland. And she grew up in communist China, so she was not allowed to know about things like fairy tales. And she wasn't really, well, she was allowed to know about fairy tales, but it was kind of
not Disney ones.
Yeah, the non-Disney ones. And she was quite, I think, like, everything she read obviously was kind of quite censored. And when now she has a wonderful little baby who I love so much, who loves story time, and she loves story time from her Auntie Ellen, even though she doesn't know what words mean. I think she's just really into the pictures and all the attention and voices I do. So because my friend doesn't know a lot of the Chinese fairy tales, I have got a book and I'm trying to like read the Chinese fairy tales to the baby. Because like my friend is like, who the fuck is Rumpelstiltskin or whatever, and I'm like, oh great, now I have to read the European fairy tales as well, because I'm trying to make this the most cultured baby in the world. So yeah, because my friend didn't grow up with the fairy tales, I'm kind of reading the fairy tales to the kid, because of course the child has to know who Snow White is, has to know Sleeping Beauty, all the classics. So I thought it was kind of interesting, though, how what culture you're in really depends on what stories you're told. And, like,
okay,
what kind of form the stories are allowed to take. You know, what's censored, what isn't.
Yeah, but also, like, this is something that I've talked about an awful lot with Deglan, my roommate, who was, you know, previous guest of the podcast. is like when we were talking about stuff that we had watched growing up, and it was like, I've not seen a lot of things. I'm sort of famous for not having seen things. I have not and refuse to ever watch Star Wars. That's my big one. But like, I've never seen The Simpsons, or and I've never like properly seen SpongeBob and things like that. But so we would have talks like this because Deglam would have watched an awful lot of The Simpsons growing up, and it would all be all these things where it'd be like, oh no, I never watched that. And he was like, well, what did you watch growing up? And I have no idea. Like, I remember like it being said that I watched Bob the Builder when I was very young, but like after that I have no real knowledge. And I think this is really interesting for like on an individual level, your point about culture being formed by the stories that are allowed to be told and that you consume. Because it's like, I have no concrete memory of that. And so essentially, like, nothing happened.
I'm just assuming that you were just in a room with, like, a bunch of Scientologists being told, no stories for you, child. You can stare at the screen for 8 hours and it's just a blank screen, and then they just like gaslight you into believing there's a story happening. Because that makes sense for why you don't remember anything. It was because it was all brainwashing.
I think my brain has blocked out an awful lot of trauma.
Yeah, I...
And taking childhood TV programming along with it.
It just went, okay, I'm just going to take all this and... Now we're.
I mean, I'm sorry about the trauma. That sucks. But to be fair, I'm missing certain years of my life as well, so I can empathize. So it's interesting because there probably were things that you watched and that are integral to your psyche, but that you just don't know what they are. So maybe one day, you know, it's like you're the Winter Soldier or something, and they'll whisper a code to you and it will like unlock the fairy tales that you and the stories and stuff that you watched when you were a kid, and you'll go from being a sleeper agent to being a killing machine. One can only hope.
Bold for you to assume I'm letting Scientologists anywhere near my ears, but go off.
even as a kid, you were just like, no, none of that.
No.
Down with that sort of thing. Careful now.
But yeah, so it's like we talked about Snow White, but like, what would you do? You have like, you know, like a memory of like a first fairy tale, or maybe like a couple first? Because like, I like, you know, like this would obviously have been like, you know, when you were really young, I'm guessing. So like, you remember?
Oh god, yes. Okay, so I had a couple of fairy tales, especially fairy tale books that I loved when I was a kid. And again, maybe it's an autistic thing, but I was like, read it again. No, again. It was like the repetition was comforting. And so I had, I had a book, Little Red Hen. I had Red Riding Hood, Goldilocks and Three Bears, Chicken Little. And they were all like little books that I'd been given. And Little Red Hen, though, was amazing because it was one of those books that had fabric in it. So I think you touch it, and there's, you know, like you can stroke her wings, but her wings are just like a piece of velvet. Red velvet, or you want to touch the fox and the foxes, like a scratchy piece of wool, like all of that. I was like, oh my god, because sensory issues. Yeah. Like, oh my god, there's soft stuff and I can just touch it repeatedly and I'm allowed to do this. This is amazing. And there's a story. I've never come down from that high of Little Red Hen, but. But I also had the story of Goldilocks when I was a kid that was in my grandparents' house. And they read me that story a lot, and it had pictures in it. It was great. But my uncle used to do this thing where we'd play Goldilocks and he would pretend to be the bears, and that at the end when the bears come in and they, you know, want to gobble her up, he'd get the cushions from the couch and he'd make me into a sandwich and then sit up and pretend he was going to eat me. And I loved it. I loved being made into an Ellen sandwich by the bear. And just like, yeah, I'm sure that had no effect on my psyche. but yeah, like he would just, you know, I think kids sometimes like being squashed, and they like being sat on, and they like being flung around, because they're still trying to like develop spatial awareness. So as an adult, you know, if somebody did put me between the couch cushions and try to make me into a sandwich, I don't think I'd enjoy it as much. But as a kid, I loved it. And my grandparents as well used to tell me Red Riding Hood a lot as a kid. And my grandparents are kind of like second parents to me. I spent a lot of time with them growing up, and I still spend an awful lot of time with them now as an adult. I'm very, very close to my grandparents. But my grandparents didn't know any fairy tales, especially my grandmother. And I remember me and my sister having like a grandparent sleepover one time at my Nana's house. And we were like, Nana, tell us a bedtime story. We demand a bedtime story, because we were little shits. And she was like, I grew up really poor in Cork, and like my parents like never told me fairy tales. And you know, she was like, what do you mean you want a fairy tale? And we were like, tell us a fairy tale. She's like, no one has ever told me a fairy tale in my life. So we were like, how dare you be born working class and having parents who had to work? We need a fairy tale. So I, being the oldest of the children, was like, ahem. So this is the story of Sleeping Beauty. I'm going to tell it to you, and then you have to tell it to me, and then I'll go to sleep. So that's what we did. And like now realizing, wow, I was such a little shit. So we made my grandmother tell us stories that way. So because she legitimately didn't know Sleeping Beauty and didn't know Cinderella and Snow White and those. But Red Riding Hood was one they did know, because of reasons, I guess. Maybe, again, it's like one of the reasons why that fairy tale has lasted so long is repetition.
Maybe it's because, you know, when you become a grandparent, you're sort of instantly become knowledgeable of the threat to grandparents, which is the wolf.
Yeah. Or maybe, you know, there's some part of your mind that's just like, Christ, this child is annoying. I wish a wolf would eat me, and I wouldn't have to deal with this anymore. Maybe it's wish fulfillment on the part of the grandparents. I don't know. But yes, so like they did know Red Riding Hood, and I remember my grandmother and my grandfather would, like, you know, we would stay over at their house, and I remember like one morning me and my sister sneaking into their bedroom and cuddling up in bed with them before we had to go to mass, because they go to mass every day, Irish Catholic. Irish Catholic mood. So we were like tiny kids, and we snuggled up with our grandparents. We're like, tell us a story. And they were like, we don't know any stories. It was like, tell us Red Riding Hood. So we kind of came up with this game where they'd tell us Red Riding Hood, and Granddad would be the wolf, and he would hide underneath the blankets, and then we were sitting on the top of the bed by the pillows, and he'd go underneath the blankets pretending to be the wolf, and he'd grab our toes, and he'd try to gobble us up, and we loved it. We were like laughing and giggling, and he would like tickle our toes and pretend that he was the evil wolf when we were Red Riding Hood, and he was going to gobble us up, and then he'd tickle our tummies, and he'd like throw us around the bed. And my Nana was probably like, I need to go to sleep. but yeah, so Nana was the was the granny in the story and granddad was the wolf. And then I got to be Red Riding Hood and my little sister, I think, was maybe Red Riding Hood 2.0. And so I loved that fairy tale so much as a kid because they used to tell it to us all the time. We used to always play this game when we were kids. On like, you know, Sunday mornings, we were really bored because we weren't allowed to like watch TV a lot. So yeah, I've always loved Red Riding Hood because of that. And again, you know, trying to bully our grandmother into telling us like Sleeping Beauty and Snow White and Cinderella, because I remember we did tell her the stories, but I love my Nana so much. She's a wonderful person, but she kept getting the names mixed up and she kept getting the stories mixed up. So she'd be telling us Sleeping Beauty and halfway through, you know, a witch would show up with an apple and we were like, Nana!
Like, that's not right. Like,
that's not right. We're like, from the top, you know? We're like, take two, tell it again. I'm just like now being like, I think I need to apologize to that woman.
Definitely.
I'm so sorry. I was like, I mean, it's not like I'm pedantic at all nowadays. That was sarcasm.
Oh. It's like I'm just leaving the site. Like, it's like I'm just leaving the silence there. Like.
I was waiting for the next point because I thought that was serious.
Yeah, though I feel like sorry, what?
I know that was me just taking a sip of water.
Sure. I was saying it feels like with the things like with fairy tales and all that, like I feel like, you know, part of as well what keeps on is like repetition, and also again, like, you know, especially when you're like a really young kid, like, you know, your parents playing like games with you. It's like when like my parents would do the, like, you know, like similar, like, you know, like when myself and my brothers were kids, like with like different fairy tales, like, you know, so I'm just like, you know, just like, some really good memories there, like.
Yeah, I remember playing Sleeping Beauty with our au pair at the time, Martha. Oh god, I love Martha. She was so nice. And Susanna. I can't remember if it was Martha or Susanna, actually. But when I was a kid, my little cousin, who was... she's like an adult now who can go out to nightclubs and she's in university. But in my head, she's still a baby. but I remember it was her christening. And that day, Sleeping Beauty came on, the Disney version came on the telly. And I'd never seen that cartoon before because, you know, back in the oldie times, we didn't have Disney Plus. Whatever was on the TV is what was on the TV. You couldn't pause it or rewind it. You just had to watch it. And so
sort of missed those days.
I do not or miss... running to the toilet in between the ad breaks and then getting back and someone
has it's back
yeah. Or when you'd have or like when you'd have one hyper specific, like, you know, everyone I feel like has one, like, you know, like video or DVD that they had as a kid that they would just watch for like mildly niche, like one that watch on repeat like forever.
Yeah, I had Barney and the Winkster, which was my favorite. It was like a live show of Barney on VHS tape, and I rewatched that to death.
God, yeah, that's after unlocking a memory now. Well, I remember we had a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles video on VHS. Like, it's strange to think that VHSs were still in somewhat common circulation when we were young.
Mm.
Well, I think actually my father sent me, as, you know, boomer parents do, a TikTok of back when we were kids, this is all the stuff we had. We had none of this modern technology, you know, as if like it was better back during the AIDS crisis. And he sent me, yeah, because Ireland in the 80s was so great. Let's go back there. But yeah, so he sent me this video, and nearly everything in the video I also grew up with. And I was like, Dad, you do realize you're not that special and different. Like, you know, it was all things like tape recorders and, you know, like the VHS tapes and the old cameras and the old computers and, you know, the games and things. I was like, Dad, I've done all this stuff. Like, do you not remember anything from when I was a kid?
Honestly, because no. I was saying I had Barney's on video, which I vaguely remember, but it was around a year. It was like the middle of July, and apparently I just wanted to watch. I insisted to my mom that like we were going to watch Barney's Christmas. Like,
yes,
like why?
I remember.
Like why do you want? I was just like gonna watch, so my mom was just like, look, just all right, let's put on Barney's Christmas. Like, I don't know if there was Barney's Day. No, that wouldn't cut it.
Yeah. One of the reasons why my parents have, you know, been able to diagnose me as autistic many years before I was, you know, actually diagnosed when I was 11, is that I vaguely remember this, but my father was telling me recently, when I was a kid, I had a really bad ear infection, I think, throat infection or ear infection, and I was very sick. And this is when I was like maybe a year old or two. I was like a toddler. I was maybe two, maybe. And I had this favorite coat, and it was a winter coat. And I put it on, and I would not take it off, even though I had a fever. And I had a really high temperature, and they kept trying to make me take off this coat. And I was like, apparently I would throw a gigantic tantrum, screaming, crying, like hitting my little fist on the ground and throwing myself on the floor as they try to take off this coat. And they just would, they couldn't get the coat off me. They're like, Ellie, you're fucking burning up. Take off the coat. And I was like, no, I love this coat. And I also was demanding that we put on this VHS of Barney and the Winkster over and over and over again, because it was my comfort thing. So I was just rewatching. I was just like a little 2-year-old bundle of coat, probably more coat than girl, with my little feces up on the couch, drinking my little apple juice in my sippy cup, watching this movie on repeat all the time until I got better. And you know, my parents just being like, why is she doing this? And now as an adult, I mean, like, I'm like, okay, yeah, well, it was probably a sensory thing. You know, that coat was my comfort thing, and I didn't want to take it off because it's heavy and cozy. And the movie was my comfort thing. So I was rewatching it over and over and over again. But now as an adult, I'm like, oh,
that makes sense.
Now as an adult, I'm like, I actually have the adult version of that, which is me wrapped in a blanket with like a shawl over my head, like one of the cozy shawlies, sitting in bed with watching Interview with the Vampire 1994 with Tom Cruise in that glorious blonde wig over and over and over again with my little cup of tea replacing the apple juice in the sippy cup. So I don't think I've come very far as a person.
You've evolved.
Yeah, definitely. I think stories could have a comforting quality. You know, we have our favorite fairy tales, we have our favorite stories, and when we're in a bad place, they really comfort us and help us get through things. Especially, I think most kids, even like, and especially autistic kids, I think, have a movie, whether it's Disney or, again, like a random VHS tape that you were obsessed with,
that you rewatched so much because it was familiar and comforting. And like, I mean, according to my father, I actually broke the VHS player in the house because I wore it out watching the same things over and over again. And not to say that the time I like tried to put a cookie into the VHS player to see what kind of a movie that would make. Very early experimental filmmaking on my part. I really think I should get more better for being like an auteur. Like, they could have used me during the 1920s, during the German Expressionism. You know, there's the cabinet, Dr. Caligari. There's Nosferatu, and then there's me and my cookie. But yeah, like, I think stories can be super duper comforting, and I think that's another important point about fairy tales, is that part of the reason why, as a culture, we tell fairy tales and why the same motifs get repeated and the same stories get told in every culture, you know, in every country, every home, like, kind of almost the same story but slightly different versions over and over and over again, is because, like, number one, we have, like, the same things so that we can remember them. And it's easier to remember things when they have, like, something in common. But also because it's comforting. And what comforted you as a kid and what you loved as a kid, you want to pass that on to the kids you're minding or babysitting or the kids that you have yourself. I mean, there's a part in there's a part in this ancient I think it's ancient Roman or ancient Greek story called The Golden Ass by Aeschylus, which is like, of course, it's kind of like a fairy tale for adults, which is what most of fairy tales were for a very long time. There's obviously stories that were told to kids as fairy tales, but then there was also a separate kind of subgenre of that, which was like the naughty fairy tales that were for adults to tell each other and to laugh at. And in this ancient, is it Roman? No, maybe it's ancient Greek. Anyway, it doesn't matter. In this very, very old story, there's a part in The Golden Ass where the kind of framing device is that there's this guy who got turned into a golden donkey. So it's not like he's a man with a golden bottom. He's a golden donkey. And he kind of has to go through the world trying, listening to all these different stories until he can get turned back into a person. And at one point, there's this young woman who is on her, she's just gotten married to this man she was in love with, and it's her wedding night, and then this bunch of robbers and bandits like kidnap, I think they kill the husband, and they sexually assault her and kidnap her, and then she's obviously not in a good place because, like, all this trauma has just happened to her. So the robbers give her into the care of this old lady who's, like, part of the band of robbers. And she's like, you know, literally says to her, "God, I'm so sorry about everything that's just happened to you. That's awful. Let me tell you a story to make you feel better." So she tells her the story of Cupid and Psyche, which is a very, very early version of Beauty and the Beast. And it's like, you know, even in ancient times, like, let's say maybe ancient Greece, like, thousands of years ago, there was still that thing of, you know, you're having a really hard time and, you know, you've just had this traumatic thing happen to you. As a way of comforting you, let's tell you a story. And, you know, the story Cupid and Psyche is kind of almost like a way of this older woman trying to get this younger woman to kind of cope with the situation she's in, where there's this band of robbers who are obviously like really cruel and evil, but you know, maybe if you're like, you know, maybe they'll, one of them will turn out to be a prince, you know, it's that kind of a mood where it's like, it's okay, you know, it will all work out in the end. And in the end, you know, the woman is okay, and it does work out. But it's, again, kind of like, don't lose hope. I'm here for you. Here's a comforting story that will kind of make you feel like, okay, maybe there is light at the end of the tunnel for me in this really hopeless situation. And I think, again, that's part of the reason why when we're sick, you know, we put on a movie that we really like, and that we've seen it before, but the story is comforting, and it kind of gives us a bit of hope and a bit of an internal pep talk. And people are doing that for each other when they are going through hard times, and people have been doing that for themselves for as long as humans have existed.
Yeah,
I like that this is something that we keep coming back to on the show, that like the way we tell stories and things like repeat throughout human culture.
Yeah, because I mean, television is a very new thing. And, you know, again, it's it's not something that everybody in the world actually has. You know, like, we think, oh, everybody grows up on Disney. They actually don't. Like my friend from China, who did not grow up really with Disney. She only watched Disney movies when she was in her 20s. And sometimes I like mention something that happened in a fairy tale to her as a joke, and she'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? You know, because she'd never heard of it. But the story, you know, tend to get passed on. It's just that now I think we just have this idea that there's, you know, there's one version of it because we have Disney, and Disney is kind of quite, Disney as a corporation has their fingers in like every single pot. And so we think, okay, this is the Disney version. It's like almost canon if it's Disney. And then because of the mass marketing and, you know, how much power Disney has, then you see that version everywhere. Like, it's different now, because when I was a little kid, for example, you know, I remember having a storybook that had Rapunzel in it, and the version of Rapunzel was the one where, you know, she's called Rapunzel because she's named after a type of cabbage. a type of lettuce. She's named after a type of lettuce. And, you know, she gets knocked up by the prince, and because she's never gotten sex ed, she doesn't know that she's preggers. And when the witch finds out that her adopted daughter in the tower, who she's been overprotective of, is pregnant by this prince, that she like beats her up and chucks her out of the house, the tower. And, you know, she ends up wandering the wilderness, and she's like miserable, and she gives birth to twins out in the desert. And then the prince comes looking for her, and because the witch cut off all her hair, and you know, she was, you know, an abusive mother figure who was mad her teenage daughter got pregnant outside of marriage. She kept the hair, and so the prince is like, Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair, and he climbs up the hair, and he sees the witch, and the witch is like, you knocked up my daughter, yeah, and you'll never see her again. And then she throws him out of the tower, and he lands in the rose bushes, and the thorns like scratch his eyes, so he's blinded. And so he wanders the earth for years trying to find poor Rapunzel, because he's got his flipping eyes put out by the witch and these evil rose bushes. And he finally finds her because he hears her voice. She's singing to a lullaby to the two twins. And he sees her, and, you know, she's heartbroken by the fact that he's been blinded by her adopted mother. So she cries, and the tears, when they touch his eyes, heal him, and he's able to see again. And because he's finally able to see, and they are happy and together, and he goes back to his kingdom, where his father's like, we've been looking for you for years. And they're all set up with a nice family, and, you know, money, and she gets to be a princess, and everything works out in the end. That is so not the mass market Disney version. Like,
yeah,
that is so not Tangled. And like, Tangled has a place, and it's a good movie, and I liked seeing it when I was like 11 and it came out in the cinema. But I think that, you know, it's become the canon Rapunzel story, whereas that's not what I grew up with. And now when you go to even the supermarket, like you go into Tesco, you see all the dolls. The dolls, when I was small, if there was a Rapunzel doll, she'd have like that pointy princess hat, which is like actually taken from a medieval fashion. Or she'd have like she'd just have the long hair, it could be in any color. Whereas now it's like, no, Rapunzel has to have blonde hair, green eyes, she has to have a pink and purple dress, this is her pet, Pascal the Chameleon. Like, everything is very much, this is the canon of the fairy tale. This is the story that you're kind of given. And that's now the version that all kids kind of grow up with, is just this sanitized version that has been mass produced by a corporation. And I'm not saying Disney, Disney movies are soulless, but I mean, they are made by a soulless corporation. So I think they lose a lot of the original intent when the billionaire's version of a story that belongs to people and has historically been like something passed down from, you know, mother to daughter or father to son, becomes, you know, the child's first interaction with that story isn't in a personal way, it's in a mass market, you know, censored, very sanitized.
I suppose, like, yeah, that's a good... Sorry, Nigel.
Because, like, it was the thing fairy tales is, like, this then also leads to people being like, oh, well, in the official version, like, there is no real official version of fairy tales, even with things like Cinderella and stuff. There's loads of different versions, and like you say, the myth of Cupid and Psyche being, not exactly, but a thematic sort of predecessor to Beauty and the Beast. But Disney has solidified and sort of codified these ideas that there's one true version of a story, which is not how stories work at all. Any story, exactly. Really.
Exactly. And I think a big part of the reason for that is copyright. You know, historically, for most of human history, there was no such fucking thing as copyright. That was not a thing that existed. It was only kind of from the 1700s, 1600s on, when, you know, the Gutenberg press was invented and people were able to start disseminating information very fast. And then, you know, in the 1600s, literacy rates started to pick up. So, like, then when someone wrote a story, they could actually make money off of it. And they wanted to be the official author. Before that, it was kind of like, if you wanted to be a writer, you had to have a patron. And the patron would maybe pay for, you know, a version of a story that you told to be printed, but it would be probably like an illuminated manuscript or something, or there would be like a very small run of things. But then when the printing press was invented, you could, if you had a story, it could go viral, as we say nowadays. Like the plague, which was spreading around at the time, and it could kind of go everywhere, and everybody could read it, and if everybody's reading something that you wrote, you kind of want to make money off of it. So that's why copyright became a thing. You know, like, for example, the stories that are popular nowadays and the characters that are popular nowadays are, there's almost like a canon of the characters and what the characters do and do not do. And that is the one version that is owned by corporations, like, let's say, Marvel, Disney, Star Wars. You know, these characters, which were dreamt up by not just a single person, but by several people working on a project, you know, making the movies, they dreamt up these characters. But the characters don't belong to them. They belong to the corporation and the business that they work for. And that business has a vested interest in making as much money as they can off that particular story. So it doesn't make any sense for them to be like, okay, yeah, well, we came up with the characters of, God, let's say, like, Bucky Barnes, Winter Soldier, and Captain America. And, oh, wait, we've accidentally put a whole ton, accidentally in air quotes, of queer coding into this relationship in the Captain America movies. So people ship the characters together. You know, oopsies. But we're, like, super homophobic because we're Disney. So we're not going to make it canon. That's where things like fan fiction comes in. Like, you know, there's tons of that kind of fan fiction on the internet. I'm not super into Marvel. But, like, I've seen it online. It's everywhere. Like, the fan art, the fan fiction. Like, people are really into that couple. But they're not a canon couple. Whereas, you know, if this story was being told, let's say, in the 1300s, in the 1700s even, there is no way that you could stop somebody from publishing their fanfiction and it becoming as much canon as anything else. There was no, like, one true version of a tale or one true version of a character. It was pretty much a free-for-all, and anybody could write anything they wanted, and anybody could kind of tell any story that they wanted. And, you know, I think that's quite a, you know, almost like a socialist kind of a thing, where it's like, stories are owned by the collective. They're for the people, by the people, and whatever is popular gets retold, and whatever people enjoy hearing gets retold. But what they don't enjoy hearing kind of gets ignored for the most part. And so, like, I think we're definitely losing something so much nowadays, where what the biggest the biggest collection of stories that we have in our culture are not stories that belong to everyone anymore. They're made for profit by people who are quite, you know, have very particular views about things like gay people, transgender people, off J.K. Rowling, and they.
But you see this as well with how Disney removes certain aspects of representation to sell films to China as well.
Yeah,
because China's government policy is very homophobic.
Yeah, exactly. So what you know, what gets put out there in the public consciousness, what becomes pop culture, is decided on based on how much money it's going to make, not on how great a story it is or how much mass appeal it has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that really pisses me off, because it's, again, like you mentioned, Nigel, it's catering to, like, you know, catering to China, for example, where they have stories, but then they censor them because they want them to make as much money as possible. And it's messed up, because the stories belong to us. Stories are oars. The characters are oars. When we watch a movie and we connect with the characters, they become a part of ourselves and they can change how we view the world. Like, they shouldn't be so commercialized, because then, you know, like, historically, let's say, that's why there's a million versions of the same story, because everybody interprets things a different way, you know? And the idea of something being canon actually comes from, surprise, surprise, the Catholic Church, because when the Bible was written, again, they wanted to decide what stories were official and what parts of the Bible were just going to ignore because they're too feminist. And, you know, they imply, you know, that Jesus may have been having a little bit too much fun with his, you know, 12 very devoted male friends. And, you know, like, they really, really censored everything at the Council of Nicaea. And they came up with, you know, what is going in the Bible, what we're leaving out. And then even after that, there was a whole section of the Bible that later got removed from the official discourse because it was considered not canon. And it was there. I think there was one particular pope who did that. I'm not completely sure, but about the exact one. But there was a pope who was like, okay, well, these are the stories that are, you know, it was called the Apocrypha. So that's where we get the term apocryphal. But there was the Apocrypha in the Bible where there were all these stories that people were telling for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know, the Middle Ages started around like 500 AD. People got really into these stories. And for like maybe around up until the 1100s, they were telling these stories as if they were canon, as part of the Bible. And this pope was like, Christ, people have made fan fiction of the Bible and it's become so popular that it's literally eclipsing what's actually in the Bible, because nobody could read.
Literally a threat to church doctrine.
Literally. So that's where the canon thing came from. He was like, guys, none of this shit is canon. I've decided, you know, that Lot and his daughters never happened, and that, you know, Judith and Holofernes isn't a thing, because how dare a woman, you know, behead a man for trying to, you know, hurt her Jewish village and also, like, be really creepy sexually to her. How dare she cut his head off? You know what? We're just going to pretend this whole part of the Bible never happened. Like, because people were literally telling fan fiction and fairy tales about the Bible because they made great stories. And then they made a ton of art about it.
Pick up the first Council of Nicaea.
Yeah.
But also, what I think is so funny about this idea is that the first Council of Nicaea, which is sort of the first proper go at unifying Christian
theology and doctrine,
I'm putting an official version down, was convened by Constantine in 320 something, right? So the Catholic Church had been established for a while, albeit, you know, like, kind of in secret. So I suppose that might have added to it, you know, because it was like sort of persecuted under Roman law. But I just think it's so funny that it took them that long to get to an official version. And now that I think about that more and more, I feel like the fact that it was so disparate and having to do this in hiding was probably the reason why there were so many different versions. Like, when you look at like Irish myths and stuff, and like Celtic folklore and stories of the Tuatha De Danann and things like that, there's so many different versions that don't cancel one another out. Like, that's the thing. People as well have this with Greek and Roman myths now, where they think there's and Norse myths as well, there's one version of them. Or, like, there has to be one that's more correct because there's two versions of the story, or they tell a character in them will do different things. But what we have in Ireland is sort of like, well, these things all happened, they're all true in the like mythological sense, because everyone was that sort of scattered and disparate in their belief system. It was like, we generally agree that these are the figures, but they can do whatever the fuck they want.
Yeah, because there is no such thing as canon unless you are trying to control the narrative. And that's the thing. It's like, why do people control the narrative? Well, for the church, it was because they wanted to, you know, control how people thought and control, you know, what they said. And, you know, it's easier to get money out of people when you can control them. And for Disney, they're kind of doing the same thing, where it's like, okay, this is canon. This is the Rapunzel canon. And all, like, any Rapunzel story that comes out in the media that is even slightly similar, we're going to sue. Because, again, they want control. They want the money. Mm. They want to have control of the narrative. But like you said, Nigel, the narrative is disparate and kind of all over the place in Irish folklore especially, and that's kind of the strength of it, because
I think the body of mythology actively defies being canonized,
because it's whatever story you prefer is the one that's real. You get to decide, and it's the same thing as fan fiction. There's I think what we see as fan fiction nowadays could kind of end up being called fairy tales or folklore if it was being told a long time ago. Because this is one of the things I really love about fairy tales, is that historically they were told by women to other women. And it was at a time when women didn't have, they were purposely prevented in the world from accessing higher education. Like, they weren't even, most of them weren't taught how to read or write. And they were stuck doing these household chores and doing these repetitive, boring-ass tasks. And then they started making up these stories to, like, keep themselves occupied. Like, if you've ever used a spinning wheel, which I haven't, I was supposed to go to a friend's farm and learn how to use their spinning wheels last summer, but I ended up breaking, like, 2 or 3 ribs because of coughing, so that's a whole separate issue. But if you've ever used a spinning wheel, my friend was giving me, like, tips and some forward information on how to spin before I was supposed to go there, because that's what I do in my free time. It's actually quite a repetitive task, because you hold the wool or the fibers or the flax or whatever it is that you're trying to turn into thread in one hand, and you spin the wheel with the pedal on your foot, and you hold the wool in one hand, and then you kind of hold, so you hold the spindle, which is like the big clump of the fiber, in one hand. You hold the little kind of thready bit that's going around the wheel in another hand, and then it just kind of, with the pedal on your foot, you spin it. So it's quite like you're stuck in this one position for ages. You have to keep your hands in the same position. You have to focus on what you're doing and, like, actually watch what you're doing. And you can't really, like, look at something. You can't read a book. You can't watch a movie. But what you can do is listen to and tell stories. So, historically,
yeah, definitely.
Women did all the spinning. You know, that's where the term spinster comes from. Is from the women who could make a fortune, like, not a fortune, but make their fortune, make their own money from using a spinning wheel and spinning. Because what spinning does is it takes a bunch of fibers, like wool fibers or flax, from which is where we get linen, and you make it into thread, and then you weave it on a loom and you make it into fabric. And that's where all fabric came from hundreds and hundreds of years. And I mean, everyone, unless you're in a very warm climate or a nudist colony, needs clothes. So, like, all the communities needed these women to do these jobs, and they needed them to spin. So they would be using these spinning wheels all the time, and they'd have to because the community needed this stuff, and like they needed, and these women needed money, they needed a source of income. But they could actually make great money and be really independent, and then they would choose not to get married because they didn't have to for financial reasons. But back then, I mean, men in Ireland nowadays are not, let's say, not the most feminine. But you can only imagine what they would have been like in, you know, the times where it was okay to beat your wife as long as it was with something smaller than your thumb. You know, you're like not as thick as
yeah,
the size of your thumb,
yeah.
It was like an actual law in Ireland for a while. So like these women, if they could choose not to get married, they wouldn't. So then that's where you get the term spinster, you know, a woman who doesn't get married. Because
she did not know that.
She was spinning on the spinning wheel. She was too busy, you know, hanging out with her female friends, talking all day and telling fairy tales and telling stories, spinning on her spinning wheel and making her own cash and being a boss babe. And then men didn't like that.
Staring Alec and Baldwin. Boss babe.
Well, no, I mean, I didn't hear what you said, sorry.
Starring Alec Baldwin.
You know, like Boss Baby, the kids' film.
The hip Oscar-winning feature, Boss Baby.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I very much avoided that film. Because the kids I was minding at the time were really into it, and I was like, Jesus Christ, you guys have no taste. I'm either a really great babysitter or I'm one of the worst babysitters ever, because all the kids I've babysat have been like, tell us a story, tell us a story, tell us another story. Because like, I have a good memory and I'm good at telling stories. So I remember like they would be like, can we watch Boss Babe? And I was like, no, let me tell you about the Darragh Dua, you know, which...
But Irish vampires are fucking great.
I know, and they liked it. I was like, and then the woman was locked in a tower and she was starved to death by her abusive husband. She threw herself in the window and then she rose from the grave and drank his blood. And they were like, ooh, tell us more, Ellen. So I don't know if I'm an awful babysitter or a great babysitter. Kids seem to like me, so that's good. But anyway, I had a point, didn't I, before I got distracted? What was my point?
You're talking about spinsters.
Oh, spinsters, yes. Like myself. One time my mum was minding a little girl, and because my mum works as a childminder, and for years I've helped her with the job, and I was like a baby and childminder myself. But this little girl said to my mother, how old is Ellen? And I was like, oh, she's 19. And the little girl said, and why is she not married?
Ooh.
Like, touche.
Harsh.
Harsh. But like in this little girl's mind, of course, she was like, well, if you're an adult, you must be married. And she was like, why isn't she married? And I remember thinking in my head, oh my God, like, can you calm down, little child? Like, I'm 19. I felt like Anne Elliot from Persuasion. You know, she's like 27 and they're like, oh my God, she's past her prime. She's a spinster. She's too old. Just go to the garden and die, Anne, and we'll bury you. You know, it's like, I'm 19, little child. How dare you? Like, oh God. But anyway, spinsters, you know, like if women didn't have to get married, they didn't really want to, which is what we're seeing nowadays. You know, women are finally getting some financial and social independence. So, you know, marriage rates
and the amount of people having babies has gone way down. And divorce rates have gone way up. Which personally I think people say, oh, well, this is proof that true love doesn't exist. I disagree. I think that when you look at things like divorce rates, it's not that, you know, true love and companionship and like marriage is a sham. I think it's that when people in the past got married, it wasn't necessarily for the right reasons, because, you know, it was kind of a social expectation and social pressure. And so when divorce kind of is starting to become an okay thing in Ireland, I mean, even in the 90s, it wasn't an okay thing in Ireland. As divorce becomes more socially acceptable here, a lot of people who have been in abusive marriages are finally getting free of that. So that's probably why we have such high divorce rates. Anyway,
definitely.
So when women kind of have this freedom, it's a great thing, because, you know, historically we didn't. And when women were kind of stuck doing these things like spinning on a spinning wheel, or stuck in the house, or stuck doing these menial tasks, and they weren't given an education, and they weren't taught to read or write, and they were prevented from having a lot of sway in the community and like political power and all of that, they told stories to each other. And I think it was a way of survival. That's why I think Cinderella has become such a, like, Cinderella is probably the oldest fairy tale. And there's a reason for that. It's because every woman who, or even just every person who is stuck in a shitty situation, dreams of, you know, a different life for themselves, and dreams of, you know, their own happy ending and their own escape from that situation. And the idea that it can happen in like such a magical way, and that you can end up rich and happy with a spouse who loves you, that's kind of the dream for a lot of people, especially people who grew up in an abusive situation. And
that's a fairy tale marriage.
Yeah, exactly. It's the dream. That's why, it's part of the reason why it's such a popular fairy tale. It's like these women throughout history, throughout time, who were mostly the ones telling the stories. Because, you know, historically speaking, childcare has been something that women were kind of made to do. That they told these stories because they could imagine a kind of liberation for themselves that they couldn't actually achieve in their real life. It was kind of a comfort thing, but also kind of a sort of hope, you know, that one day maybe things won't be so dire, and kind of passing on this message to the kids that they were looking after, that, like, well, you know, one day maybe you will marry a prince, or maybe you will marry a rich merchant, or maybe you will marry, like, a, you know, a bear who lives in the woods, and you'll have a great time and you'll live happily ever after. You know, I might not be able to achieve that because I'm stuck with this miller or stuck with this farmer, but maybe one day you'll get off the farm and you'll go seek your fortune, and you'll need to know things about, you need to know like these essential truths about society and about the way the world works. So in order for these kind of facts of life to sink in, I'll dress it up as a story. Like, we still do that. There's a lot of morality caught up with fairy tales. And to be honest, I think a lot of the sort of, like, okay, how do I phrase this? When people started becoming much more literate, that's kind of when fairy tales start to become very moralistic, because of the Grimm brothers and Charles Perrault, who were, you know, kind of two of the biggest people writing fairy tales and actually writing them down. And you know, there's that phrase that saying that it's the victors who write the history. And it's also, but I think something really important to note is that, yeah, the victors write the history, the winners write the history. But actually, it's the people who know how to read and write who write the history. And everything else gets forgotten, which is another thing that happens with, like, Irish mythology. It's like, a lot of it is lost because it wasn't written down. And because in Ireland, we had a tradition of oral storytelling. You know, it was memorization. People didn't write things down. Like, the ancient Celts didn't write stuff, except for Owen stones, which were, like, kind of, this is so-and-so's land, stay out of it. Or, like, this stone marks where, you know, Henrik, son of Hodor, is buried. You know, it was just, that was kind of all they used the Olm for, as written language. Stories were an oral tradition. They were person to person, and storytellers had, like, great, you know, sway in the community. Like, I think there's, like, a Brehon law, the ancient pagan law in Ireland, where if a poet, like, told basically made a diss track against the king, or a lord, and, like, made a poem making fun of him, then he could have the poet killed, like, just on the spot, because it was, like, such a big
Whoa.
Deal. Yeah. So, yeah, like, when it comes to things like morality and stories, whoever writes stuff down, that's what lives on, I think, the most. And it's almost kind of a shame, because there's probably, like, we have a lot of versions of myths and fairy tales and folklore that have survived from a very long time ago. But, like, there's more that have been lost because they weren't written down. Because the people who were telling them, either because of race, class, gender barriers, weren't given an education and weren't taught how to read and write. And so the people who were able to write are the ones who write history and are the ones who create the culture, who write the stories down. And then it's their version that lives on the most. And like, there's some wonderful people working in fairy tales and folklore who actually go to these kind of disenfranchised communities and speak to the people in the communities, get them to tell them the stories, and then they write them down. You know, like in the islands off the coast of, is it Galway, I think? And I know in the Bear Peninsula, they, around the turn of the century, during the Gaelic revival in Ireland, there were folklorists who went out to these small islands and talked to the old ladies there, the Pagines, who would, I don't know if you guys remember Peg, the Irish woman storyteller that, like,
I'm aware of it, yeah.
Traumatized by. Yeah. But, like, those kind of old ladies who were, like, you know, my husband died in a boating accident, my son died in a boating accident, my child died in a boating accident, God, I fucking hate boats. You know, like, those kind of miserable old ladies. I hate saying that. But, they, you know, that kind of a thing. And they would get them to tell their stories and their folklore and their fairy tales, and they'd write them down and save them. And that's an amazing thing. And, like, there's still people doing that, going to, like, poor communities, rural communities, any kind of community that's been disenfranchised, be like, hey, tell us your stories and we'll write them down and publish them in, like, a folklore or a fairy tale collection. And I think that's really important, is that stories don't become a monolith and they don't become, this is the one true version.
because then who decides what the one true version is? The person who holds the pen writes the history. Who is that person? You know? So, like, when getting back to fairy tales, when literacy became such a big thing, there was such a big market for books. And before that, you know, things weren't as codified. But the Grimm brothers, you know, they wanted to kind of have these. I mean, if you can imagine the kind of dodginess and kind of prudishness that two upper middle class men in Germany in the 1800s, sort of Victorian era, would have had. they probably weren't like going to Victorian gay bars and having a grand old time and super cool, and you know, like they had a sort of set morality from their time and place and class. You know, they were really interesting people. They were folklorists, and you know, they wrote down what they heard, but then they censored the crap out of it, and especially when it got translated into English. So the Grimm brothers, it was Johann and Wilhelm Grimm. I could be getting that wrong. They are such interesting people because they are such huge liars when it comes to so many things. They fully lie about where they got their stories from and, you know, lots of things, and they edit everything. So they say in the introduction to the first volume of the Grimm Fairy Tales in 1812, they're like, oh yeah, well, we got these stories because we went all around Germany and we spoke to all the old beggar women and all the like old ladies and all the old people in the countryside and the most obscure parts of the Black Forest, which is an actual place. I have a friend who lives next to the Black Forest in Germany, which is supposed to be like where the witches and all of that happened in the Grimm fairy tales. And I'm like, can we please go to the Black Forest? So someday me and Ava are probably going to do that. Because that's what I see as a fun time. It's like, let's go get eaten by a witch like in Hansel and Gretel. get abandoned by our parents and have to follow a trail of breadcrumbs. But they basically said, oh yeah, we like totally talked to all these really, you know, down to earth peasanty folk, and that's where we got all our stories. They're the true stories of real Germany. Like, yay, German culture. There was like two women in the city that they lived in who were upper class ladies that they talked to, and that's where they got the majority of the stories.
The Grimm's so, just like, I love to lie.
I love to lie. They lied about so much. And I love that they got away with it as well, which I find hilarious, because in the 1800s, you could kind of just show up to a town and just be like, yes, I am a prince. Where, you ask? From Nigeria. I've been stuck in an airport for so long. Please give me all your money. You know, like, you could say anything. People would believe you. So the Grimms were, in some ways, kind of really clever storytellers, not just in terms of telling stories, but in also lying their asses off. They loved to lie their little German asses off. And they were good at marketing themselves. Like, they wrote this book. They wanted to make money out of it. So their collection of household stories is what it was called originally. And then it got really popular. It was originally written for adults, which is why it's gory and gave me incredibly nightmares as a kid. But it was all intended for adults and for these spinsters who were passing their time spinning
fibers at home, and for, you know, the different disenfranchised people who were stuck doing menial labor. And then the Grimms were like, oh, well, we are making a lot of money out of this book, which is all these stories that were for adults. Let's try and... But they're becoming quite popular with people reading them to kids. So let's, like, try not to traumatize the kiddies and get sued. So let's edit the crap out of it. So the book went through so many different editions. It was like nearly every 2 or 3 years they had a new edition of the work published. And they cut out more and more and more as time went on. And then eventually, you know, in Germany, the book got really popular. So they were like, let's, you know, contact a publisher in England and make even more money. And when stuff got translated to English, they censored it again because the English were even more prudish than the Germans. So the versions of things that we have nowadays that people online are like, yeah, the original version of Cinderella, she got like her toes, you know, the evil stepsisters got their toes and their heels cut off and their eyes gouged out by birds. Yeah, it was so dark. It's almost like that thing online where they're like, yeah, this is the original fairy tale. It's dark and it's creepy. Like, well, that, yes, is a fairy tale, but it's not the original. Like, there's no original. And it was written by two people that we can actually, like, look at them and look at their lives and look at how they compile these stories. It's not just, like, a universal truth or something that the stepsisters always get their toes cut off. Like, there's versions of Cinderella in... The oldest version of Cinderella is actually in ancient Egypt, and it's supposedly based on a real person. Yeah, let me just take a sip of water because I've been talking for so long. Sorry, 1 second. So, like, in ancient Egypt, there was the fairy tale of Rhodopis, which was about a woman who was enslaved in ancient Egypt, and she was called Rhodopis because she was so sunburned, because she was, I think, Greek, or she wasn't native Egyptian, and she, like, she had pale skin, so she was getting fried by the hot Egyptian sun working in the fields, and the slave owner person, he gave her this pair of golden sandals because she was like, I think there's versions of it that say she did wicked things with her tongue and wicked things with her hands. So, I mean, I'm not sure how consensual all that was, but anyway, he gave her this beautiful pair of golden sandals and things. And there were two other slave women there who were kind of like the ugly stepsisters who were really shitty to her and bullied her. One day, Rhodopis was walking around with her golden sandals and she took them off to bathe her feet in the River Nile. And this eagle swooped down and took one of her sandals and flew off and dropped it at the feet of the pharaoh. And the pharaoh was like, oh my god, there's a woman with really tiny feet somewhere in my kingdom. And I'm so into that. So the king was like, someone tell me who could own this golden sandal. And then, you know, he met Rhodopis. It was like, she's really pretty and she's really nice. I'm going to make her one of my wives in the palace. So he did. And apparently she's a historical figure. The first kind of Cinderella is in ancient Egypt. And I mean, according to history, she was actually a real wife of the pharaoh, a real person. But yeah, so, you know, that was the version of Cinderella that is supposedly the original. So it makes me really annoyed when people online are like, the original fairy tale was this, this, and this, as if like it's kind of like a screw you, Disney, or screw you, people who like happy endings. I'm like, well, in the original happy ending, there are no birds gouging people's eyes out. There's just a girl who's been through a really tough situation who finally gets to spend the rest of her life in luxury with a guy who's really into feet.
I mean, fair enough.
I mean, get what you can get, girl. Like, it's ancient Egypt. I don't know how many options she had, but, you know, being the wife of a pharaoh isn't too bad as things go. I mean, she's probably being fed dates all day and, you know, plums and, you know, having a great old time. She's probably very, like, the fascinating thing about this is that the story went on for so long in Egypt that they were like, oh yeah, the enslaver who owned her, in air quotes owned, was Sappho's brother, and you know, she slept with Aesop of Aesop's Fables, and Herodotus met her, you know, the father of history, and like she met all these famous people. So she's an interesting character, but yeah, there's no original version because the stories belong to the people who tell them, and again, to the people who write them down, but mostly to whoever wants to keep telling the story. The story is yours.
I like that. I think that's a good place to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Ellen, where can we find you?
Well, I have an Instagram account with my full name, which is Ellen Farr Art, which is where I post the art that I do in college. I'm an art student.
Go follow her. Her art's great.
Thank you. 100%. So I have that. I'm Bunny Moon on Instagram as well, and most other places on the internet. But yeah, that's kind of two good places to find me. I mean, I'm over on Facebook. If any listeners want to get in touch and tell me how amazing this podcast episode is, you can probably find me on Facebook as well. Pretty classy. I mean, I'm not super online type person, but that's where you can find me most of the time, posting my art on Instagram, Ellen Farr Art.
Nice. Nigel, where can we find you?
You can mainly find me on Twitter at SpicyNigel, where recently I've been tweeting about Michael Cera and J.K. Rowling and the fact that I got blocked by Andrew Tate on Twitter, which I'm...
It was so funny.
So cool. I love that for you.
That was an incredible moment.
Oh my God, I love that.
The list of famous people that have me.
That's impressive.
Iconic. You can find me on Twitter at AliCat_Ali, spelled like alleyway and cat spelled with a K. And you can find me on Instagram at Ali, Ally_K_Keegan. You can find the podcast at HyperFixationsP on Twitter.
Or at HyperFixationsPod on Instagram. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, be that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or just wait for it to grow up like mold. You'll find it where you least expect it. If you would like to come onto the show to discuss one of your hyperfixations, please feel free to reach out at any of the aforementioned social media. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you didn't, nobody likes a fucking narc.
And that is it for this week. Ellen, you were an absolute delight to have on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on again. Goodbye, everyone. Signing off.